Timothy Talks, Season 1, a podcast designed to kindle afresh God's gift in every Christian. Join us as we explore the ups and downs of the church in our earliest centuries. Greetings and welcome to Timothy Talks. My name is Matthew Risher. Alongside me is Daniel Pensimone. And we're excited that you've decided to join us on this journey through the early church history. This is an exciting episode. This is our first episode of this season, and our hope is that you'll learn, you'll grow, and you'll be edified by really what this podcast provides. So turning our attention now to the topic of this first discussion, we're talking on the fall of Jerusalem. And before we get started, a quick quote from Josephus: "The war which the Jews made with the Romans has been the greatest of all that we've ever heard of." So we're going to turn it over here to Daniel, and he's going to tell us a little bit about the background of the fall of Jerusalem.
Thank you, and I am excited as well to be here. We're talking about Rome triumphant, the fall of Jerusalem, and there's a bit of a background to this story. The story starts before the time of the New Testament. Before the time of Jesus, Alexander the Great had swept through several hundred years earlier and taken the whole region of the Middle East, turned it into a Greek-speaking area. And for some time, the Jews were under the government of Alexander and then his successors. Eventually, though, a man by the name of Judas Maccabees comes to the scene, and he revolts from these descendants of Alexander and starts his own kingdom, which is called the Hasmonean Kingdom. For some time, the Hasmoneans exist as a separate entity, and eventually, as Rome becomes more and more powerful, Jerusalem and Judea becomes sort of a petty kingdom underneath the Romans. Now, if you remember Herod the great king who tried to kill Jesus, killed all of the newborns in the land of Bethlehem in that city, Herod the Great is one of these kings who rules the petty kingdom of Israel. But after the time of Herod the Great, the Romans decide that they want to have more control over the Jews, and so they incorporate it into the empire as a separate province, the province of Judea. And this is the situation that we come to about the time of 70 AD. Now, in the time before that, about AD 66, some trouble comes up. All throughout its history, Israel is a real pain to the Romans. They're constantly disagreeing with the Romans, refusing to obey different orders, and the Romans have a lot of trouble with this province. But it all comes to a head in 66 AD. So there's this Roman whose name is Gessius Florus. He's one of the commanders in this area, and he needs some money, but he doesn't have money for the government. But he knows where to find it, and that's in the temple. The Jews give money regularly to the temple, and Gessius Florus says, "Hey, why can't I have some of that? I need it." So he just goes in and takes the sacred money. Well, you can imagine that the Jews are not very happy with this. They are livid that a Roman would do this to the sacred money. And because they can't really fight the Romans, they use a very powerful weapon, sarcasm. And they start to mock Gessius. And they say, "He's just a beggar. He has to live on the proceeds of the temple because he's too poor." And they really make him out to be just this poor guy that needs Jewish help in order to survive. Well, Gessius Florus is not pleased by this. He's so angry that he sends his soldiers, they gather up some random people who have nothing to do with this, and they crucify them just as an object lesson to the Romans.
So we see pressure is beginning to rise. There's this divide between the Romans and the Jews, and it really is culminating to what we're going to have really with the fall and the destruction of Jerusalem. So why don't you start to talk to us a little bit about the events that really unfolded and descriptions of this siege.
So after this boiling point is reached, the Romans are faced with an all-out revolt by the Jews, and the Jews gather up soldiers, they gather up weapons, they start to fight the Romans, and this goes on for several years. It's a multi-year war, but eventually the Romans take everything except for a few spots, and one of those spots is the city of Jerusalem, because the most radical Jews take refuge in the city of Jerusalem. They're determined that they cannot give this city over to the Romans. Now, I've got a couple people to talk about. One of them is Titus. Now, Vespasian is one of the Roman generals, but partway through the war, Vespasian is called from Judea to go over to the city of Rome, and he actually takes command of the entire government of Rome. He becomes the next Roman emperor, and his son is Titus. He leaves Titus to fight the siege of Jerusalem and to overpower the city. Inside of the city, we've got several important people. We've got Eleazar, John, and Simon, and these are three people who are in charge of factions within the city, groups of Jews who want to rule the entire city. but they're all fighting each other. They don't present a unified front against the Romans.
Now, just for our listeners' sake, when you're mentioning some of these names, such as Titus or John or Simon, you're not mentioning the people whom we read about in the New Testament scriptures, are you?
No, definitely not. These are common names in that time. So these are just people who don't have a connection with the biblical story of the New Testament, but common names of people in this period. And you've got these three in particular, Eleazar, John, and Simon, who are fighting because they want the city themselves. They don't want to share it with other rebels. And this is really bad for the city of Jerusalem because the city has so much food that it can last for a siege of many years, Josephus tells us. But the rebels are destroying each other's food supplies, which makes the city much less defendable.
So they're, in a sense, fighting themselves for the Romans.
Exactly. There's a sense in which the Romans could just sit back and do nothing. But I mentioned this man, Josephus. He's a very important person. He's a Jew, and he's a Jewish general. He starts the war on the Jews' side, fighting against Romans, and partway through the war, he's captured, and he switches his loyalty to the Romans, so he's a traitor to his people. But he writes a book. The book is called The Wars of the Jews, and it outlines in great detail this entire description of what we're talking about. The Romans love him. He paints the Romans as good guys and the Jews as bad guys, even though the Jews are God's chosen people, according to Josephus. Yet they're people who have gone away from God, and therefore the Romans are this divine instrument to bring judgment on him. So he's a very interesting person and a very controversial person at this period. He tells us, though, about these different things, and he describes this city with these three groups fighting, and the common people, the townspeople, are caught in the middle of this. They're not powerful enough to stand up against any of these warlords, Eleazar, John, and Simon. And these warlords are using every method that they can, every type of cruelty, every type of trickery, to get an advantage over the city. So, for example, at one point, it's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and Eleazar controls the temple complex with his soldiers. And he says, I'm going to open up the temple complex so that any Jew can come in here and worship God with me. We're in this war, but let's have sort of a unity for a day. And so a number of Jewish people come into the temple. Well, John sees this as an opportunity to take over the temple. So he sends his soldiers in, disguised as town people, with their weapons hidden. And then in the middle of this festivity, they attack Eleazar and his men, and they take over the temple complex. So there's really no sense at all of let's work together, entirely at each other's throats. Well, the Jews are using this strategy on the inside of the city, and they're also using it on the outside against the Romans. They're constantly coming out to the Romans saying, we surrender, groups of them, and then the Romans come up and they destroy them. And so the Romans have this very hesitant approach towards the Jews. They can't trust them because there's so much trickery, so much deceit going on in this war. And there's famine inside of the city. Very soon they start to eat up all of the food that's left. The gangs and the warlords are breaking into people's houses, seizing the food, torturing people to take their food from them. And in the middle of all of this, Josephus says, neither did any other city ever suffer such miseries, nor did any age ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than this was from the beginning of the world.
So we really see a terrible situation, something that in modern history we haven't seen, where you have a people group inside of a city really destroying themselves, and outside the gates is an enemy that is seeking to destroy as well.
Exactly. The Romans, at first, are somewhat sympathetic to the Jews, but very quickly they decide not to be sympathetic to the Jews. And people in the city go out into no man's land to try and find anything that they can. I mean, they're chewing on leather, they're so hungry, so they're going to the no man's land trying to find food. And the Romans make it a policy that if we find a Jew outside of the city, we're going to take that person and crucify them in sight of the city to terrify those who are in the city. I mean, you can't even imagine a modern army functioning this way. It's so barbarically outside of what we consider to be normal in warfare, but this is how the war is being fought. 500 people a day are being crucified by the Romans inside of the city. There's so much destruction going on.
So whether you're in the city or outside of the city, you're not safe. You're either dying from starvation or you're dying at the hands of the Romans in a crucifixion.
Exactly. There's no good place to be at this point if you're a Jew. Well, we come to it's the year 70 AD, and in particular, the date of August 10th is a very important day. This is the day that the temple is burned. The Romans eventually pushed their siege so far into the city that they burned the temple, and Titus had been very specific, according to Josephus. Titus said, don't burn the temple. I mean, it's this magnificent building. It was started by Herod the Great. Construction has been going on for decades. It's one of the most magnificent buildings of the ancient world and the Roman Empire. And Titus says, don't burn the building. But in the heat of battle, a soldier takes some flammable material and throws it into one of the windows, and soon the entire temple is burning. And Titus rushes there. He tries to save the building, but there's really nothing that can be done. There's still a skirmish going on right there. There's bodies laying in the courtyard of the temple. Josephus describes a scene of so much bloodshed that soldiers are slipping on the blood as they chase each other back and forth.
Yeah, this is a really graphic and gruesome scene, but really shows us just the severity of what was going on at this event.
Yes, and after the temple's gone, it's not much longer after that that the city itself completely falls, and the Jews who are still alive, who survived the famine, are captured by the Romans. And again, in a description of how different this is from modern warfare, after they're captured, they're all sold as slaves. Some of them are sent to Rome for a triumphal parade through the streets of Rome for the Romans to demonstrate their martial conquest. But most of these Jews are sent to slavery, living the rest of their life in mines or other places.
Now, Josephus has some numbers for us, and as you're going to get into, some of these numbers may be exaggerated, but nonetheless, they're staggering. Why don't you tell us a little bit of some of these accounts and numbers that Josephus has for us?
Yes, like you said, we can't necessarily believe them completely because they probably are exaggerated, but Josephus says 1,100,000 people die of the Jews in this siege, both through famine and through actual fighting. He says that right after the siege ends, the starvation, though, is so bad that 11,000 more die after it's lifted. And he says that 97,000 people are carried captive and sold into slavery. So even if those numbers are exaggerated, we're talking about tens of thousands of people who have to experience this nightmare.
Yeah, and it's not just tens of thousands, potentially even hundreds of thousands. I mean, this is a full-on assault. But something interesting about this event is it's not lacking biblical implications. There's something to be said about the biblical account, the New Testament account of really what's going on here. And if you could just shed some light into specifically even the words of our Savior.
Yes, it didn't take long before Christians began to think of this event in biblical terms. And I want to read just a couple sections from the New Testament that could make you easily think about the siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD. In Matthew 24, Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. So we're right there in this historic place. But he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." And that certainly would make a person who lived through those events think about this time when the Romans come, and as Josephus says, knock it all over.
Yeah, and we even hear about this time period, how there's accounts of Roman soldiers going through the temple and literally turning over every stone to find jewels or gold or any kind of treasure they can find, because the temple is so valuable.
Exactly. Jesus also says in Luke 21, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near." He says, "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart, and let not those who are out in the country enter it." And obviously, if you live through these events, this is a time when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. So at the least, it's going to make you think, is this what Jesus is referring to? But then you have this very interesting quotation in Hebrews, chapter 8, verse 13. The writer of this book says, "In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away." And it's quite a prophecy that he's making here. He's saying this entire system of Jewish religion that's focused around a temple, focused around the priesthood, that's what he's been talking about before this, it's about to vanish away. Well, there's several different ways that people reconcile these biblical texts to the biblical events. One of them is this approach called preterism. It's the idea that all of those prophecies were pointing to 70 AD. And even the coming of Jesus is fulfilled in the year 70 AD in completion. We don't look forward to another coming of Christ. It's already happened in 70 AD. That's very hard to reconcile all of the biblical information with that, but that is an approach that some people have. I personally think that's a very dangerous approach. A much more reasonable approach is called partial preterism, and it's the idea that those prophecies point to 70 AD, but they also point to more. So Christ is still coming again. We're still awaiting a second return, but what he's done already at 70 AD is a picture of his ultimate coming back in judgment on the world.
Yeah, it's almost as if it's a near fulfillment to a final and far fulfillment that Christ will bring to us one day and maybe one day here soon. So that's a good point to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the implications that this event has had on the city of Jerusalem, the Christian church, and the Judaism.
We are so excited that you're joining us for Timothy Talks, and to show our appreciation, we're giving away over $400 worth of free gifts. Let me tell you about our current giveaway and how you can have a chance to win. Not every believer is called to the foreign mission field, but every Christian is called to live a life on mission for the glory of King Jesus. In January, thousands of God's people are going to gather in Atlanta, Georgia at the G3 Conference. The upcoming theme is the mission of God, a biblical understanding of missions. The G3 Conference will host many gospel-centered speakers, including Vodi Bakum, Tim Challies, Stephen Lawson, David Platt, and John Piper. They'll ponder questions like, what is the mission of God, and how is the Great Commission applicable today? At Timothy Talks, we appreciate the work of the G3 Conference, and we want you to be there. So in conjunction with the G3 Conference, we're giving away 2 free tickets. So how do you get a chance to win? Well, it's simple. Just send a quick email to timothytalkspodcast@gmail.com and mention today's keyword, Jerusalem. That's right. Send an email to timothytalkspodcast@gmail.com and mention today's keyword, Jerusalem. Every episode, we will give you a new keyword, and each time you enter the keyword, you'll get another entry in the drawing. So the more you listen to Timothy Talks, the more chances you'll have to win. So don't forget, send the keyword to timothytalkspodcast@gmail.com and tune into future episodes for more chances to win.
And we're back here on Timothy Talks. Now, we've just finished talking about the siege and destruction of Jerusalem. We've talked about the words of Christ and biblical viewpoints on this. Let's talk about some of the effects that this event has had. First, on the city. How has this event really affected Jerusalem?
Jerusalem goes from being a city that's primarily a Jewish city to a city that the Romans want to rid it of any Jewish influence that they can. They're only partially successful. But quoting from Alec Isaacs, I'm going to read a few quotations just that describe what happens to the city afterwards. He says, along with the destruction of the temple, the entire city of Jerusalem was left in ruins. The city was overrun and converted into a garrison town for the 10th Legion, which was stationed there. He also says, the pile of rubble which stood on the Temple Mount was pushed aside, and in its place a temple to the goddess Aphrodite was built. The glorious city of Herod was all but completely destroyed. The vessels of the temple were carried away in triumph to Rome, where an arch, Titus's arch, was erected to celebrate the victory. The arch portrays the scenes of conquest, showing Roman soldiers carrying the famous menorah and other temple vessels from Jerusalem to Rome. And this is actually an arch that you can see today, Titus's arch. So if you're interested, go and check that out.
And not only did this event, you know, impact the city of Jerusalem, which obviously it would, with such a significant event, impact the city, but it also left its impact on Christianity. Why don't you touch a little bit on how this event in 70 AD affects Christianity in the early years and even the effects it could have on us today?
Absolutely. Because this is why we're including it, because it had such a profound effect. Early Christian writers tell us that the Christians who were in the city of Jerusalem fled to the city of Pella a little while before the Romans actually came. So in that, according to these early writers, they were literally obeying the words of Jesus when he said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, flee to the mountains. So these Christians leave the city before the siege happens. And as a result of this, the Romans and the Jews are suddenly at war. This is a war between these two camps, and Christians are caught in the middle of this because up until now, they've always been viewed as a a sect of Judaism, a subtype, a denomination of the Jewish religion. But when the Christians leave Jerusalem, and the Christians say, we don't need the temple to continue to exist, and we're not taking the Jewish side in this siege, suddenly the Romans begin to realize that there is a major difference between these two groups. Christians are not just another group of Jews. There's actually something unique about them. And so from this point on in history, Christianity has a new position among the world religions. It also takes on this new Gentile feel because, as you can imagine, if the Jews are a conquered people who have been humiliated in a victory parade in Rome, and their city has been destroyed and the temple is ruined, Christians are not naturally going to want to say, oh yes, and I'm a Jew too, like all of those other prisoners right now, like all those slaves who were just sold at a market. So as a result, the Christians begin to become much more Gentile in their feel, because they're trying to appeal to their Gentile neighbors and say, we're still valid, even though that may have been destroyed. So it takes this new Gentile feel, and really when you ask about how does this affect us today, I would say it does so ourselves. When many people think of Christianity, they think of a Western type of religion, a religion that has a great deal of its roots in the continent of Europe. Not that it only was a European phenomenon, but Christianity was able to, as Paul would say, become all things to all men, as opposed to always being a Jewish subset.
And not only would this have a massive impact on Christianity at that time, and even today, but it has far-reaching implications on Judaism. Why don't you touch a little bit on how this event has impacted the Jewish people?
The great place that Judaism had to have to survive, or so they believed for a long time, was the temple. Without a temple, you can't have sacrifices, you can't have a priesthood, you can't do so many of the commands that are given in the Mosaic Law. So you can imagine that for a religion that's based on a place as pivotal as the temple, there's going to be a major blowback to losing the temple. Now, the Sadducees, the Essenes, the Zealots, these groups that existed in the time of the New Testament, they disappear from history because they didn't have a response to it. They couldn't imagine a Judaism that did not exist, that existed without a temple. It was beyond their comprehension. There was one group that was able to accommodate itself to this. It's the group of the Pharisees. The Pharisees had always regarded the temple as an important place, and without the temple, it's been said that more than half of the Mosaic laws could not be completed. So at first, this looks like a major difficulty for the Pharisees, but they're actually able to create a workaround to the temple, and that is to remember the temple, to continually think back to it, and to prepare themselves for a future day when a temple would come back to them. Now, Alec Isaacs, quoting him again, he says, "The rabbi is able to reconcile himself with Roman rule because of his conviction that life, even without the temple, is preferable to death." This is very different from the groups that were fighting the Romans. They would say, it's better to die than to live without a temple. But the Pharisees can get around that. And in other words, he says, there is Judaism without the temple. But at the same time, the rabbis of Yavne insisted that Judaism was very altered by the destruction. The message of the generation of Yavne, these are the Jews who come after the time of the destruction, was that Jewish ritual, study, and prayer must now become vehicles for keeping the memory of the temple alive. And he even goes on to talk about specific traditions in Judaism, such as at a wedding, you take a glass and the groom and the bride crush this glass. And he shows how that is a tradition that evolved from the destruction of Jerusalem, a reminder, even in the most joyous periods of life, that the temple has been destroyed and there's something wrong with the world.
Yeah, truly earth-shattering event that we got to cover today. Well, as we wrap things up, you know, Daniel, how we're going to go about this is really going to see, why is this important to us? Why does the destruction of Jerusalem, why does this event that happened nearly 2,000 years ago, why does it matter to us today?
Two reasons. The first is that God's preserved his truth. And you can see how God's sovereignty is working in this. We probably wouldn't think that the destruction of a city is necessary to save a religion, as it were. And yet God's sovereignly orchestrating this siege to happen in such a way that it pushes Christianity into the Gentile world in a very remarkable way, so that his truth and his gospel can go to other people that it may not have gone to otherwise. And then the other way, of course, that we see this is God is magnifying his son, and he's always doing this throughout history. When we come to the Siege of Jerusalem, we see this, especially as we look at these prophecies of Jesus and understanding what Jesus is saying. There's a lot of people, myself included, would say that there's at least a sense in which these prophecies that Jesus gives are being answered in this history right here. So God's magnifying his son. He's taking the words of his son, Jesus, and he's working them out. They're not just empty words. They are true. And God is vindicating his son against those who crucified him.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. I mean, that's all we have for today, but we do want you listeners to remember this, that your theology, a high theology, leads to a high doxology. The more truth you know and believe, the more you will love and worship the God who made you. Till next time, I'm Matthew along with Daniel, Timothy Talks.